Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Hi there. We're going to talk to David Pepper here in just one second, but I have to tell you, summer is all about grilling, and no one understands grilling better than Omaha Steaks. Their grand summer grill out package lets you stay at home, lets you social distance, and eat like you're at the best steakhouse in town, all for much less. They've got bacon-wrapped filet mignon, pork chops, chicken kielbasa, and more, all delivered to your door with ease. And right now, Omaha Steaks is offering an exclusive deal on this amazing package. Go to omahasteaks.com, enter the code LIBERAL in the search bar, and for this week only, Omaha Steaks will add 4 burgers and 4 gourmet jumbo franks free with your order. Omaha Steaks delivers guaranteed quality and safety with every order. Go to omahasteaks.com, type LIBERAL in the search bar, and order the Grand Summer Grill Out Package. For this week only, you'll also receive 4 jumbo franks and 4 burgers free to complete your steakhouse experience. omahasteaks.com, enter the code LIBERAL in the search bar. And now, let the cartoons begin.
Broadcasting from Resistance Headquarters, relentlessly fighting back against the clown dictator and his regime of deplorables.
Never give up, never surrender.
This is the Bob Zeska Show, presented by BubbleGenius.com.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, July 29, 2020, and this is the interview edition of the Bob Zeska Show on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. My guest today is the great David Pepper. David is the chairman of the Ohio Democratic Party, as well as the author of a brand new book out now titled The Voter File, a fiction novel about foreign interference in a Wisconsin special election and a reporter's journey to unravel the plot. His previous book, The People's House, accurately predicted the Russian attack against the 2016 election. Today, we're going to talk about what Putin might have up his sleeve for this election, as well as the status of the campaign in Ohio. Meanwhile, if you like what you hear today, please help support this show at patreon.com/Bob Zeska Show. All right, let's talk Russia and Ohio with David Pepper. Before we dig into Ohio politics and your most recent book, The Voter File, I'd like to talk about 2016 and your previous book, The People's House.
Explain
what happens in that particular novel. I think our listeners are going to find it eerily familiar.
So it's an interesting history. I started writing that book in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of came up with this plot about I'd worked in Russia years before.
Yeah.
And so the heart of that book was about a Russian oligarch who rigged an American election.
Wow.
And I wrote from 12 to 15, edited it a bunch and put it out there in the middle of 16. And, you know, as I joke, it was supposed to be fiction and then it came true. So that was my first book, and I've been writing ever since.
It was about this time, 4 years ago, about late July, when we first really learned that it was Russia behind the DNC hack. I mean, was that utterly mind-blowing for you? I mean, you had to have known, obviously, that something like this might be in the works, but to actually see it happen in real life a few years after you started the book, it must have been mind-blowing.
So, honestly, the heart of the plot I wrote, you know, 2 or 3 years before. I mean, yeah. That's what was so strange about it.
Yeah.
But I think part of what happens when you're writing a book is you're sort of imagining, well, if you wanted to do something, how would you realistically do it? So I think the reason it came to sort of mirror what happened was I was thinking, like a bad guy, if I wanted to plot about rigging the American election, what would I actually do?
Yeah.
But I mainly chose a Russian because I worked in Russia years ago, and I know a little bit about it, so I came up with this character. But yeah, so the heart of it came before I had any inkling of what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
I put it out in the middle of 16, and people liked the book, said, well, that's great, and they would write, boy, I hope that never happens. That sure is scary. And then after November, when it really became clear what had happened, that's when people would say, what in the world? Because, you know, some of the aspects of the book that it's not just the overarching plot, but there's specifics in there about, you know, the Russian guy, and not to give it all away, I hope people read it, he buys a voting company. Well, that actually happened in Maryland around 16.
Yeah.
It's a lot of it's driven by the Russian oligarch's interest in fracking and pipelines, gas pipelines in America. Well, who's buying up that kind of stuff in Kentucky? Russians.
Wow.
I mean, so there's a lot of weird things that were prescient. And the other one is, and I, you know, we have to still explore this, but I also got very specifically in how you might hack a voting machine. And it all comes down to taking advantage of the fact that we never really know why people choose not to vote in certain elections, the undervote.
Yeah.
And that was sort of the heart of sort of the hack. And that's something that if you talk to voter integrity people, one of their great concerns is the way you could hack voting machines is to simply throw out votes occasionally that change an outcome, but no one would ever know why. So, yeah, it certainly was interesting. I did not set out to predict anything, but I think when you're trying to write a realistic, you know, worst case scenario of what might happen, in this case, you know, you're able to pinpoint pretty quickly what are the vulnerabilities of our country right now, and it's all about politics.
Yeah, and you worked for CSIS, Center for Strategic and International Studies, and through that organization, you had the rare opportunity to actually interact with Putin. Tell us how that came about and what you observed while negotiating with this guy.
So yeah, that's sort of my Forrest Gump existence when I was in my 20s, that I was sort of meeting these famous people, but they weren't famous yet. I was in my early 20s. My first job out of school was an intern research assistant for Zbigniew Brzezinski at CSIS, which is a think tank in Washington.
Yep.
But from there, I got a job as part of a task force, basically, that was working, and this was back when we got along well with Russia. Early 90s, Clinton and Yeltsin, you know, were always out laughing together and working together.
Yeah.
And my job was trying to help bring technical assistance to St. Petersburg, the most Western city at the time, that would bring like the kind of market reforms that we thought Russia would take on somewhat naively as a country. We did. And so we were there doing all this work, but the point person to my project, which was chaired by the mayor of St. Petersburg, was the vice mayor, Vladimir Putin, who was
amazing.
This very quiet, serious. Well, the irony is, at the time, he was so different from the other Russians. Like, the mayor at the time was a guy who everyone thought would become president. Very charismatic, very intellectual.
Mm-hmm.
He had been the dean of the law school. He had written the new Russian constitution. Other figures around him were equally impressive. Putin was the one who I literally thought, who's this guy? How'd he get this job? He was quiet and serious, not very different from the others, but he did make the trains run on time. And as I've written, and I always worry the Russians are going to get onto me for this, 2 years in, this is when I first started really getting an understanding of him, 2 years into meetings with Vladimir Putin, he had never spoken a word of English. And in the middle of one conversation with an interpreter, she must have messed up a word that he had said in Russian. And it was not some simple word. I can't remember what it was. And he corrected her in English. And I knew enough Russian to kind of get it. But I'm thinking this was not any old word. If he knows that word, he knows a lot of English, and we never once knew it.
Wow.
So my interactions with him basically make me very worried whenever I hear about the president talking with Putin. This is a guy who would be running circles around Donald Trump.
I mean,
Every call they have is taped. Putin understands what Trump is saying in English, and then the interpreter translates for Trump. I mean, that's a nightmare. And when, so whenever I hear that Trump is ripping up the interpreter's notes or doing one-on-ones, I mean, every one of those phone calls is, I'm sure, a national security disaster.
Mm-hmm.
Because Putin is a very savvy and wily person. I saw it myself. And by the way, the thing we were working on was completely like in partnership with St. Petersburg. Yet still for 2 years, he still didn't ever say anything in English until he corrected her.
Yeah.
So when he's out to get us in different ways with Trump, I mean, he's totally clearly running circles around him.
Yeah.
It should scare the heck out of everybody that Trump's having all these calls with Putin.
Was there any indication at the time that Putin may have aspirations for bigger things, and not just the presidency, but also some sort of aspiration to meddle in elections? Was there any intention along those lines?
No. I mean, when he was named, so the way it went down, when Yeltsin was leaving, with about a month left, they named Putin prime minister, and it was obvious that that was to make him the successor. And I couldn't believe it. I thought, wait, that's the guy, that's the vice mayor. How did that even happen? So I would never, there were a number, like I said, I would have expected the mayor to become the head of Russia. That was the talk. There were other vice mayors that were actually very impressive, and, you know, but my problem in that assessment was I was not sizing up the way Russia really ended up working, which is that old KGB connection, the connection to oligarchs. That's what mattered more in Putin's rise than the things I was looking at as a 22-year-old kid in the early 90s, thinking I was looking at it from a sort of what would an American politician look like.
Yeah.
And so the more westernized ones stuck out as the ones that I thought would go on. And so, no, I wouldn't have sensed that ambition. Putin had I just remember when I worked there, he had a affinity for sort of the way the German economy works, which is much more dominated by large banks. I mean, that seemed to be something separate from the work I did with him, that he was often doing work, and he had done some of his KGB, you know, work in Eastern Germany. So, I would never have predicted that he would rise. I mean, he would, if you had had 10 of the Russians around me that I knew, and again, a lot of these were Western-minded, he would have been, you know, maybe not 10th, but on the list, not the one I'd say that person could go on to this incredibly, you know, serious and now very troubling role. I would say, though, that there was also kind of a sense that some of the people that were most admirable, like the mayor of St. Petersburg, was truly into a small d democracy, and you felt it.
Yeah.
I mean, and he had been a big player in the Russian Constitution. He stood up. Remember, there was an attempt to roll back some of the reforms. This guy had stood on a tank in St. Petersburg to stop it. You never got that sense of a democratic instinct from Putin. He was more like the operations guy. He made the trains run on time. I wouldn't have predicted the negative we're seeing, but I also he didn't give off the vibe of I'm someone who believes in sort of democratizing a country either. It was like he was the practical guy who got stuff done, basically.
At what point, with Putin holding higher office, first prime minister and then eventually basically president for life, I mean, that's what we're looking at now with Putin. At what point in that progression through higher office in Russia did any red flags start to raise in your head? Like, okay, there's going to be some trouble down the road from this guy. Were you observing him that closely? Were you seeing the indications?
I left. So I stopped my work in Russia in 96 and came back. And so I was more watching from a distance. But
yeah.
I was surprised when he was picked. I wouldn't have predicted it would be as bad as it is.
Mm-hmm.
I did conclude from my time there, this was a savvy character, very not at all similar to sort of your traditional Western-style political figure, and he would be a practical, like, guy. He would get things done without as much of a concern about, you know, democratic niceties as we have. But, no, I would not have thought – I mean, and I just think it's been a slow – you know, every year it's more and more clear how deeply problematic he is.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have predicted he'd rise, but I wouldn't – I didn't know enough about – you know, I knew he was a former KGB spy. But I think what might have been – the biggest red flag at the time would have been that he was selected at all.
Yeah, right.
Because this was some other group saying, this is the guy. And he wasn't rising in a way that you'd expect in a sort of a, you know, a more modernizing democracy. This was a selection by people. This is going to be the guy we put there, and that's what happened. And so, and he was coming out of leading essentially the Russian, you know, version of the CIA or the Homeland Security. The fact that he was picked with a month to go should have been a red flag to everybody that our notions that you know we were going to have this democratic Russia that we sort of naively thought we'd get when Yeltsin was president.
Right.
That was all out the window the minute you had this very sort of closed door selection of his successor, of someone who had no history of any sort in actually these types of positions. He was more of a backroom guy. Like, he was the guy who made stuff happen. He was not the out front political figure until he was literally named prime minister. And that's when I was, it just, to me, the shock of it was, wait, Putin, that's not who was even seen in St. Petersburg, is the public face of the city.
Right.
And now, next thing we know, he's prime minister.
Was it a failure of American intelligence? Was it a failure of Western intelligence in total? Or was it Putin's savvy, as you said, as a backroom guy, that kind of blindsided us come, you know, 2014, when you have the Sochi Olympics, and then right after that, you have Crimea
right.
and Ukraine, and all, and then, of course, the attack on the American election a couple of years after that. How did that come as such a surprise to Americans when that all went down?
I think, you know, and I look back at my own time in Russia, I think we were really naive about how hard it would be to take Russia from the old Soviet style and do a transition that would truly be a democracy in a market economy system. And I think it and then underestimating how much they could move back to nationalism. And by the way, I think the whole thing makes me sad. I actually really enjoyed my time in Russia.
Yeah.
There were some wonderful human beings I met. The next generation when I was there was eager for something new. And I just think that we made mistakes, that we were naive, our intelligence wasn't great. And then once Putin was there, I also think we didn't adjust enough to realize – listen, this guy, you know, in a weird way, like, the tougher we are, the more I think we'll get somewhere with a country like Russia. What a guy like Putin, and I can say this somewhat from my interaction with him, I don't want to overstate it, but I think a guy like Putin respects when his adversary is strong.
Huh.
And that's what they're used to. And a guy like Putin is sizing up his adversary, strong or weak. If they're weak, Trump is incredibly weak.
Yeah.
If they're weak, I take advantage of them. Mm-hmm. If they're strong, I've got a deal. Hillary Clinton, they viewed clearly as a strong adversary.
Yeah.
They didn't want her there, but if she were there sort of going toe-to-toe, like an Angela Merkel would or someone else, I actually think there's more respect than if it's someone like Putin, like Trump, who's doesn't say a word about anything and gets run over.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do think that that we did not size that up. I mean, I would even criticize late in the Obama administration. I don't think they were tough enough. I think Putin is he's looking for weakness. He's looking for people who won't stand up to him. And if he senses that, he'll move in. And if he senses no, this other country, this other adversary is tough, there's almost a respect level. This is kind of a small item, but the American co-chair. And some of your listeners will like this or not like this. The American co-chair of my project, the Russian co-chair was the mayor. Mm-hmm. The American co-chair was Henry Kissinger.
Wow.
So, again, this is my Forrest Gump life back then.
Yeah, it's amazing.
You know what? Henry Kissinger was a tough American, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
They loved that Kissinger was the co-chair because they respected that he was this large, tough guy, this large, tough figure. And so that was one of the reasons they valued this work I was doing.
Wow.
So I think if when it comes to you know, dealing with Russia, I think the mistake you make is to actually show weakness, and then they take advantage of it. And Trump, he obviously is a blustery guy, but they know how pathetic he is. They know how weak he is, and they take advantage of it every single day. They knew that Hillary Clinton is not that.
Yeah.
And I think that would have made for a tougher role for them, but I actually think – if you're trying to long-term, I mean, I think our goal should be to try and find a better world than we're in right now, where we're literally like getting closer and closer to real, you know, acrimony with all these other powers.
Yep.
I think being a tougher country will lead to a more stable situation than being a weak country they take advantage of. And I do think for 15 years, we have not gotten that right.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think of 2014 as being the turning point with Putin, where Americans finally went, oh, God, okay, now we see what he's up to. But actually, I go back to even 2013 and what happened with Edward Snowden, where Edward Snowden is escorted from Hong Kong to Moscow by WikiLeaks attorneys, and then arrives in Moscow and is basically given a free pass. Here, come stay, enjoy, you know.
Right.
And he's hooked up with Anatoly Kucherena as an attorney in Moscow. Where do you peg all of that as part? Was that sort of just something that landed in Putin's lap, or was that something that he maybe had been cultivating leading up to it?
I honestly don't know enough to say there, but I do think that I do think, you know, there is a sense from Russia that we were celebrating so much their decline.
Yeah.
And it was insulting every year that it happened. This is one reason Putin came to power. Yeltsin, in the end, they thought was an embarrassment. And that America was celebrating their decline, and their pride was, you know, injured, to say the least, through the 90s. And so, yeah, any way they could stick it to the country that had kind of, you know, rubbed it in their face that they collapsed, like the Snowden thing. Grabbing the Olympics was a big win.
Yeah.
You know, all that. I mean, that's why you see these Russian, they can't help themselves, the Russian TV, they laugh at the fact that Trump is seen as Putin's person.
Jesus.
This is like the turnaround from the mid-90s, where they thought we were sort of humiliating them. Now they're watching, saying, look at. So I do think a lot of that stuff is all sort of a reaction to the mid-90s. And I you know, it's easy to say all this and going back in time, I don't know what the perfect answer would have been, but I do think in the mid-90s, it was a little bit, we were too naive to think, hey, the wall came down, these countries are just going to embrace all this, and here we go. And I just think that we weren't as sophisticated about it. Now, in Eastern Europe, it did happen. The story that isn't told enough is how much, you know, the Czech Republic and Poland, and there's other, well, they're having issues now too, but overall the transition there was much smoother. Now the democratic systems are, you know, voting, depending on the country, for people who aren't so good.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was the deeper lift that was needed in Russia and in Ukraine and the former Soviet Caucasus was just I don't think we really thought about it as deeply. And we thought, you know, a few friendly meetings and friendly relations would get it done. Clearly was a lot more that we need to do.
Yeah, speaking
of and do it without, and then do it without humiliating people, so they built up this resentment that you know, Putin won, and the same reason that Trump won with Make America Great Again. It was,
yeah,
we make America, make Russia great again, get our pride back. That was a lot of what brought him in and why he was so popular for a long time.
And in fact, isn't part of that expansionism? I mean, that would explain Crimea. That would explain Ukraine overall.
Yes.
Is there any ambition along those lines to expand into Eastern Europe again? Is that kind of on the table for Putin? Is that a long-term goal?
I think wherever you see Russian population, you know, Russian ethnic population, and that's how they think about it.
Yeah.
I would think that there's, you know, that's somewhere there. I mean, obviously, Ukraine, Eastern Ukraine is the most obvious example.
Yeah.
But no, if I think the Baltics and other places, there's probably always a concern about it.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I worry so much, not to sound paranoid, but when they see Trump as weak as he is, and, you know, just today, you know, more troops coming out of Germany. I mean, Trump is doing everything that Russian foreign policy wants us to do.
Yep.
And I do worry if Trump, you know, when Trump loses, who knows what Russia might try if they think that they only have a few months left with an American president who will do nothing about it.
Wow.
I mean, if he's not willing to bring up the fact that they either stole an election or are putting bounties on American troops, they're thinking, what else could we do that he won't do anything about? That's a really, when you think about it from a national security perspective, that's a really scary moment for our country.
Oh, yeah.
That you know, one of the keys, you know, is, you know, I don't know your age. I'm 49. Like,
in fact, my birthday, I was born less than a month after you were.
So
we're the same age. Yeah.
So we grew up when like we had this crazy deterrent theory and nuclear weapons and all mm-hmm. that, and that was all kind of scary when you look back at it. But there was some security that came out of, you kind of knew what each side would do.
Yeah.
And right now I am worried that Russia may think, and they may be right, that we won't do something because of Trump if they take a very hostile act.
Yeah.
And that kind of – that in the past, no one would ever dream of that. And that's the kind of sort of unequal understanding or misunderstanding that can lead to major problems.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if they roll troops into the rest of Ukraine, if they did something somewhere else – you know, would Trump get on the line with Putin and tell him he wouldn't do anything about it or beforehand? You know, that kind of uncertainty when they would have been certain before that we would actually do something.
Yeah.
That's a really risky moment in, frankly, our world. And the other thing that scares me, again, not to only talk about things that are worrisome, but like when you see that General Milley unwilling to say no to showing up in Lafayette Square. And then you see the Russians saying, man, that general, he did exactly what Trump told him to do. It was what a crazy. Well, all of a sudden, again, that leads to the potential for misunderstanding or underestimation about what hostile acts might lead to. And mm-hmm. I think between now and the inauguration of President Joe Biden, I mean, there's a real risk about that. You know, about a moment where Russians might think they can get away with something that they otherwise would never think they could get away with.
Oh, yeah. And Trump has handed Putin the keys to the kingdom, and that's for sure. But, I mean, the question is, and the question I think everyone's asking is, what exactly is it that Putin has on Donald Trump? What is the manipulation here? Is it Trump Tower Moscow? Is it compromat? Is it money laundering? I mean, what's your guess on that? I mean, what is
So I wrote a whole second book about politics beyond the first one, and it's all about compromise.
Yeah,
and so I don't want to act like I know anything in particular, but here's what I would have said about a businessman of Trump's you know size, which mm-hmm. in the grand scheme of the business is not that big.
Yeah,
you know, he's not sort of a massive Fortune 500 company setting up shop in Russia. He's a mid-level at best real estate guy. To do that, the time he was doing it, you had to do all sorts of cutting of corners.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you were as ethical as can be, and Trump obviously is the opposite, to get a business up and running, to do the Trump Tower, you're doing all sorts of things that aren't appropriate.
Yeah.
And if you're doing that in Russia, everyone knows it. Everyone has receipts. That alone is material that could be that's clearly there.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be – it'd be shocking if they didn't have it. Let alone other things that might be there. But here's the compromise that is to me more even relevant than what originally might have gotten Trump feeling like he couldn't say too much about Russia. It's every single time they have a conversation. It's every conversation about the election in 16, and we know things happened. And then it's everything after. It's every phone call. You know, it's every time Trump has said anything for 3 years to Putin that's been recorded and America never knows what was said, that is one other item that could be used against Trump publicly by Russia and everyone knows it. You know, whatever he said at Helsinki when they tore up the interpreter's notes, there's compromise right there.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever, you know, whatever was said to Trump Jr., you know, back in the election, you name it all. So that's why when I go back to my initial meeting with Putin, I believe that every single time they interact, they are developing things that that would hurt Trump if it came out, and that's all against him, let alone whatever transactions or interactions took place back when he was there. You know, you probably heard the same things. I never was in Russia before it was Russia, but you didn't go to the Soviet Union back in the 80s without being followed.
Oh, yeah.
And I think when I was there, it wasn't quite so bad, but then – you know, in the late 90s and 2000 after, the whole sort of mobbing up of the place got worse. And so Donald Trump would have been walking through a world in Russia when he was trying to do deals, the beauty pageant, when everything he'd done would have been sort of watched, it'd be receipts. But I think he's developed more of the problem since he's been president, probably.
Yeah.
At any moment they could say, you know, hey, that phone call we had a year ago, that could be trouble. I mean, So they've got it all right now. And it's bad when Donald Trump will turn on anybody. He'll criticize anybody except for one person.
Yeah.
Vladimir Putin.
Yeah.
And somehow he has no discipline in his life whatsoever except for one thing. And it's that he will never, ever criticize one man. And that tells you something's going on.
Yeah.
Besides that he has some inclination that he likes the country of Russia.
Well, that's,
it's too much.
Ultimately, that's the main thing about this. I mean, other than the international intrigue of it, the attack and so on, the consequences of it, is that it's so obvious. We all see it. It's so clear and unequivocal. And yet we're being gaslit on all of those things.
I mean,
what was your reaction to Trump's interview with Axios? There was a clip that came out today in which he said the Putin bounty story is fake news, while also saying that the intelligence never made it to his desk. It's one of those things where the news is fake, but the leak is real.
And the worst, and the worst part is he also gave the Russian answer on, well, yeah, we did that to their troops too. I mean, that's what Putin would say. That's what Putin would say.
Yep.
So I agree with you. I actually think that we have sort of been gaslighting ourselves for 4 years because we continue to be shocked by it.
Yeah.
It's like, wait, that's what you would – if you are basically, you know, somehow in trouble with Putin and can't ever say no to him, everything he's doing is exactly how you would behave.
Mm-hmm.
And so our media – I mean, people – I guess people don't like to talk about it. It feels a little conspiratorial, blah, blah, blah. But I actually think that the continued shock of it is almost us fooling – us almost pretending that it's not as bad as it is. And the thing I keep saying is – and again, this is – this is sort of the writer in me talking, because when you're writing books, you're thinking about worst case scenarios.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden, they make more sense than the denial of what actually is happening.
Oh, yeah.
I think in a year or two, let's assume Trump loses, I think it's going to be a lot worse than anything we're thinking about right now.
Oh,
I think that the depth of it, these phone calls, what they're talking about, the connections. I mean, just as an example, they were working so hard to create a back channel a couple years ago.
Yeah.
We think they just stopped trying to create one? No.
No.
think there is one.
Yeah.
There's one that exists. There's no doubt to me that they didn't, Jared Dumley goes over to try and do it at the embassy. Somewhere they created it, and it exists. I don't think they just stopped trying to have those back-channel communications.
Yeah.
I think they actually succeeded in figuring out a way to do it, where Trump, separate from his chief of staff and separate from others, could actually have. So I just think we're going to find that, and this is true with just the corruption generally, I think when this is over, and this is why they're going to fight so hard to not lose, I think we are going to find that the level of corruption, the level of tentacles back into whatever the Russia interaction is going to be more shocking than we even think now. And the behavior of Donald Trump is why I think that. He just won't go – even the interview you mentioned today.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just he can't do it. He won't go there. And it just tells you everything you need to know.
Unfortunately, COVID-19 infection rates are exploding across the nation. We know it's common sense that everyone wears a face mask. And finally, most states have put mask mandates in place. Despite what Louis Gohmert says, face masks are still our best way to protect ourselves, our family, and our community. But what happens when the mask you thought you were buying is fraudulent or worthless? The FDA has provided a list of authorized respirator mask manufacturers. Finding those masks has been a challenge, and verifying their authenticity is even harder. Right now, thenewdealshop.com has FDA-authorized respirator masks with anti-fake authentication on every package to ensure you're getting exactly what you need. These masks are tested by the NPPTL in the United States and provide greater than 95% filtration. They've even been used in the medical community, too. Right now, these masks are in stock and ship for free for my listeners when you add the code SEXYLIBERAL, two words, go to thenewdealshop.com and order your supply today. That's thenewdealshop.com. Get them and keep yourself, your family, and your community safe. You know what everyone hates in this time of pandemics and social media and Zoom meetings and all that crap? You know what we hate? We hate when people put unauthorized screen grabs and photos of us up on their social media pages. It's always when we're looking the weirdest, too. We're not at our best sometimes, and somehow all of our friends and family find those photos and they stick them up there without asking our permission. Two solutions for you. a no unauthorized photos policy with your friends. And of course, I'm talking about Plexiderm. Plexiderm is a clinically studied serum that visibly eliminates your wrinkles, crow's feet, and under eye bags, all in the comfort of your own home. Plexiderm goes on clear and lasts for hours, so nobody's going to know that you're using it. Go to tryplexiderm.com, use my code VOICES for half off a full-size bottle of Plexiderm, plus an additional $10 off. Or try a $14.95 trial pack today by calling 1-800-685-1292 and mentioning the code VOICES. Again, visit triplexiderm.com, use the code VOICES for half off a full-size bottle, plus an additional $10 off, or try a $14.95 trial pack when you use the code VOICES at triplexiderm.com. Thank you.
The Bob Seska Show.
Tell me, David, about the new book, The Voter File. You mentioned that is sort of pegged off of Compromat. It has more to do with a plot to undermine a special election, yeah?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, so the second book with the wingman is more on Compromat. It's the third.
Oh, okay.
It's the third. The new book is called The Voter File.
The Voter File.
Basically, what it does is it takes sort of the first two into a sort of deeper direction. It almost is assuming that we've solved the problem that our election systems themselves aren't able to be rigged, which is not the current state of things.
No.
And it basically takes. You know, there was obviously hacking of the DNC in 2016. Mm-hmm. That was part of the overall plot.
Right.
And they hacked emails. We know that. You know, poor John Podesta got his emails hacked. That was terrible. We know they were looking at polling. But every once in a while, if you see the articles about 2016, they'll say, oh, they also were trying to get voter data.
Yeah.
And the book, The Voter File, is essentially what would happen if – a hostile force, be it a country or anyone, managed to hack into the voter file or voter data of campaigns or parties. And the point of the book is that is actually the far bigger risk. Emails and polls are one thing. You can get embarrassing details. You can use it in different ways. But if you got into the voter file of a major campaign or a party, you're essentially got your arms around their playbook. It'd be like stealing the playbook of an NFL team before
That's
the
right.
game.
Yeah.
And so this book is sort of the it's fiction, but it's also but again, so was my first book. This is what would happen, what damage you could do in a fictionalized way, mm-hmm. if a hostile entity were able to get their hands around, in this case, the voter files of both parties, and how that would allow them to really do major damage to elections up and down the ballot without ever touching a voter machine,
yeah.
without ever touching a Secretary of State's, you know, voter database. And so, you know, as I've gotten with other books I've written, you know, people read it and say, man, that is a really scary prospect.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, the number one the lesson is everyone who's involved in campaigns and parties needs to protect this stuff very, very, you know, as hard as they can, and mm-hmm. they do. But it's sort of walking through. And the other thing that's been interesting is a lot of voters have no idea that these voter files even exist, where there's all sorts of information about them and details and all that. And I think it's also incumbent, you know, today we have a hearing with Facebook at Congress, and we're always concerned about what does Facebook do with data. Well, I think parties and campaigns need to be equally protective of the private data that they accumulate as oh, yeah. they build towards campaigns. So there's also a lot in it about monopolies and how much they're sort of dominating politics. But so all my books are basically there's a reporter, sort of a down and out Youngstown vindicator, mid-sized reporter who kind of falls into and this happened in the first and third book. There's sort of an odd election result. He doesn't quite, it doesn't seem big,
yeah.
but all of a sudden he starts digging and it's this big, much bigger deal. And so, as you mentioned, the special election was a Supreme Court race in Wisconsin. And ironically, there just was a big one 2 months ago.
Yeah. That's what I was
yeah.
thinking.
Yeah,
oh my God.
Again, I wrote it a couple of years. I wrote the heart of it a couple of years ago, but I picked Wisconsin because they actually do have special elections for Supreme Court. Most states don't.
Yeah.
But the data manager of the winning candidate calls up everybody and says, "I don't think we won this campaign. I'm the data person. It doesn't make sense that we won." Mm-hmm. And everyone's looking at her like, come on, that doesn't make any sense. But my reporter, who's kind of down and out, is like, I need to find a story. And she says that he doesn't really believe it, but then she starts showing him how the voter file works, what the data looked like going in the election, and says, there's no way we won that election. And when he starts digging, he figures out that that special election wasn't hacked for its own right. It was sort of someone perfecting in preparation for a much bigger election coming in November. So that's sort of the heart of the book.
Is it difficult now to write political fiction? I mean, given how factual reality is growing increasingly weird on a daily basis?
You know, it honestly is, because I write these things thinking, man, this is one crazy plot.
Yeah.
And then you know, a month later, like, Trump's doing something crazier. I don't know if you saw today, but I almost tweeted this out. You know, my second book also is all about a sort of a conspiracy to add candidates into a primary in order for one candidate to benefit by other candidates taking away votes from the favorite.
Oh, that sounds familiar.
You might call it the Kanye West conspiracy theory.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's all about, like, that's literally the plot, is you add someone to the primary to really tank another candidate. And so I'm watching this Kanye West thinking, well, there's the wingman, that's my plot.
Yeah.
But today they had the one thing I'd say about Trump versus my plots is my people are much more effective and smart. Yeah. They had a thing today with Kanye West where, like, a bunch of the signatures where he's trying to get on the ballot in one state were clearly all forged by one person. And you look at them and it's so obvious. I almost tweeted, you know, in my plot, my bad guys were actually a lot smarter than this, and they wouldn't have been so sloppy. But so, no, it is funny how – so one of the things I try and do is, so it doesn't seem like I'm just writing about things that are happening. I do try – now that after the first one happened, and I was ahead of the curve.
Mm-hmm.
Thank God I put it out in middle of 16 before people would have assumed I was just writing about current events. You know, I do have to challenge myself to think ahead and get in front of the curve. And so with the voter file, I did that. I've actually just finished a few months ago the draft of my next book. I try and get ahead of it and hope that real life doesn't catch up.
Yeah.
Because then all of a sudden you have a plot and people, you know, so if you ever go to my Amazon reviews, one not too long ago was, well, way to go, genius. You just wrote about what happened. I'm like, no, my book came out in 16. None of this had happened yet. So,
amazing.
So you do have, it is sort of a risk.
Yeah.
And, it's a challenge. Mm-hmm. And the other thing about writing. And so one of the truth is, I started writing fiction with two purposes. One was to tell good stories, and if you don't do that in fiction, you won't succeed. But the other was actually to give a view to readers what real politics looks like and to hopefully inform them about what's really going on. So the first book, the reason I came up with that plot was actually it's sort of a not a lecture, but really trying to explain how bad gerrymandering is.
Mm-hmm. Right.
My second book is all about dark money. My third book is all about monopolies and how they dominate. So there's actually a deeper point to these books, which is beyond party, to get people thinking about issues about real politics. And I think that's been an important part of my book succeeding, because people right now are so concerned about what's going on in the world that a lot of fiction is just not being read. They're reading Mary Trump's book. They're reading, you know, nonfiction just to keep up with how crazy our world has become. And so my book sort of, they're fiction, but I try it, but I don't want to feel like, you know, what's the book? What's the TV? Like Scandal, or what was Kevin Spacey series? I don't want to feel unrealistic, so people are just, you know, dismissing it. I actually want people leaving my books thinking, boy, I hadn't thought about gerrymandering that way. It really is a problem. Or dark money. You know, people will say to me, is that how it works? I'm like, yes, I've captured the way dark money kills our system.
Mm-hmm.
And so I try, in one way, I think it's not just competing with the real world. I try and have it be something that, and people have read my books repeatedly, say to me, hey, your books always inform me about how politics really works. I have a letter that just sitting at my desk here from an 85-year-old woman who wrote me out of the blue. I don't even know how she found me. The heart of her letter was, I learned so much from your books about the war, about the world and the way the politics works. And that's another way that in addition to trying to entertain, which does get hard against the Trump craziness, that hopefully people who follow my books, one reason they do is they're educational.
Yeah.
And I've heard that again and again.
It's just incredible. I mean, every single one of those topics, whether it's gerrymandering, dark money, attacks on our elections from hostile foreign governments. I mean, these are all the top shelf things that we're facing as Americans. I mean, these are the top potential disasters and disasters that have already occurred that we have to confront. And it seems like you're right on the vanguard of that. I mean, even in advance of the vanguard, it's extremely impressive to see how ahead of the curve you are, but it doesn't take much to notice that these are all things that are starting to stack up and starting to strip away the integrity of our elections and have been for some time now.
Yeah.
And that, I guess, turns us to Ohio politics. I want to ask you a few things about that before we wrap up, David. I mean, one of the minor controversies that arose about a week ago or so was news that John Kasich was invited to speak at the Democratic convention. I mean, I'm not sure how that all sussed out after the fact, but what's your take on the politics of that invitation?
So I don't. I think that was floated. I don't know if that's confirmed or not.
Yeah.
And the politics of it are interesting. So there's obviously I have been very critical of Kasich as governor.
Yeah.
He did a lot of things here, especially in his early years. You know, attacking unions, undermining schools. A lot of stuff. He gerrymandered the state. He was one of the people. So I mean, the state is you know, struggling because we've had 10 years of really bad policies, and Kasich was a big part of that.
Yeah.
At the same time, I respect that he is one of the few Republicans in recent years who will publicly stand up against Donald Trump, and good for him. You know, we ask people to say what they believe to be true and put country over party, and so when they do, be it Mitt Romney or John Kasich, if we don't say good for them, no one else is ever going to do it.
Yeah.
And I do respect, and I think it's very sincere, that he is offended by Trump in every way possible.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and despite the fact that I couldn't disagree with him more on a lot of his policies as governor.
Sure. Yeah.
So when that was announced, a lot of people who are remembering the governor's side are really upset, and I actually understand that. I don't think this is not some obvious decision one way or another. But on the politics of it, what I would say is – We are now a toss-up state. We are a toss-up state in Ohio. Every poll shows that we're basically even.
Yep.
We are mainly a toss-up state because a whole lot of Republicans, just like John Kasich, moderates from suburbs, more moderate than Kasich, do not feel any allegiance left with the Republican Party. Mm. And this is largely women. And these are suburbs of Ohio that aren't some small part of the state. Collectively, these suburbs are the largest voting block in Ohio.
Wow.
And these are the places that only a few years ago Republicans would run up huge numbers and win. I mean, the reason a George Voinovich or a Bob Taft or a Kasich would win would be because they'd run up massive numbers in the suburbs I'm talking about. They'd lose the cities, but the suburbs were the key to their victory. Those suburbs are turning blue very quickly. It changes dramatically the mathematics of winning Ohio. If their old base is now essentially toss-up or blue, you know, a good campaign can win Ohio that a few years ago wouldn't have won Ohio.
Yep.
And here's the reason I think that whoever's doing this, and again, I have not had direct conversations, those people are taking cues from people like John Kasich.
Hmm.
And so, you know, John Kasich, one reason, you know, people, we didn't win the governor's race in 2018. Mike DeWine won it.
Yeah.
Against in a year that Sherrod won by 7, John Kasich endorsed Mike DeWine late.
Mm-hmm.
I think that moderate endorsement, giving a signal to these moderate Republicans, DeWine, although DeWine's very conservative on a lot of issues, we're upset that he won. He's done a decent job on COVID for some of the time.
And you ran against DeWine in 2014.
I ran against him in 14, yeah. Right. I ran against him in 14. But I believe that John Kasich signal to these shifting voters that DeWine's more like me and less like, you know, Sherrod Brown's opponent, Jim Renacci, and less like Trump, actually saved DeWine along with a few other things in a year that he might have otherwise. I mean, DeWine was losing all the way in the last couple of weeks. He was told by pollsters he was going to lose the election. He was told it was over. And I believe that one reason that he held on, and you can see it in the data, He did not lose in the suburbs by as badly as other Republicans. And I think the Kasich endorsement, and particularly women giving DeWine a shot, saved DeWine from the fate of so many other Republicans in these suburbs, and that was a difference. So, you know, if despite the fact that we disagree with many things he says, I actually think Kasich speaking out, whether it was the convention or on CNN or whatever, however he does it.
Yeah.
And I think there's a fair debate, should it be at the convention? You know, I'll let the party and the Biden campaign decide that. But I think for those voters who are – some of them are still not Democrats yet.
Mm-hmm.
But they can't stand Trump. You know, a guy like John Kasich saying, I'm good with Biden, that's a signal, just like it was in 18 for Mike DeWine, that actually might move the kind of a few percentage points voters that could change the outcome. And I think that's why it's being looked – that's clearly why it's being looked at. And I think that people in Ohio will tell you that – The brand that DeWine was in, the sort of the Kasich moderate wing, versus the right wing, was a very important reason that DeWine did not suffer the same fate as Republicans in other states who just are getting so crushed in the suburbs they can't win.
Yeah, correct me if I'm wrong, David, because it seems like we're in the midst of a realignment here, and John Kasich seems to be at the head of that. I mean, he seems to be one of the leaders of that realignment of people who are, you know, more or less lifetime Republicans who are starting to look at the Democratic Party as a possibility, since the Republican Party has gone just full red hat, I mean, for the most part. And as you said, Ohio is right now, and according to the polling averages, a 1-point race between Trump and Biden. So we're talking about, I mean, all Kasich needs to do is to bring another 5% of Republicans to the table, 3% of Republicans to the table, to shift that balance greatly in favor of Joe Biden. It seems nuts to turn that down, don't you think?
I will say, I get the – we fought him so hard on major issues that I don't want to dismiss people who are not happy about it as if – we're talking about – core issues of labor and woman's right to choose that he was terrible on.
Mm-hmm.
So I get it, but I also think that I do think that him standing there and here are the kind of voters we're talking about. They know they don't like Trump, but they're seeing ads right now that Joe Biden is going to unleash criminals all throughout the suburbs. I mean, I saw one last night in on my TV here. It's ridiculous. But those voters are literally we got 97 days between now and the voting day. They are going to hear a million ridiculously misleading and horrible things about Joe Biden.
Yeah.
And at that point, they're not going to know which way is up. And that's where I think if a guy like Kasich is saying, hey, guys, I'm seeing all this, Joe Biden is a good guy. I mean, I do think that could sway the voters who are not for Trump, but are going to have heard so much BS about Biden that they really aren't going to know what to do. I do think he could move votes. He's moved votes. He moved votes in the governor's race. I believe that. And I do think he can move votes. So I don't think it's an easy call, because I do think, you know, and I was one of them. Like, we fought so hard on issues that we disagree with him on. And so the way if he is picked, the way I would frame it is, listen, we're not endorsing his views.
Yeah,
he's endorsing our guy.
Exactly.
It's not like
right.
It's not like I'm saying that I agree with. No, I'm proud to have fought, and we stopped. One reason John Kasich changed on some issues is because when he tried to destroy collective bargaining in Ohio, he was defeated just so badly.
Mm-hmm.
So on some things, he figured out I'm not in lockstep with Ohio at all on these things. Others, he never stopped. I mean, Ohio's legislature has tried to ban abortion every which way every year. He signed most of those. But the point is, if it is him, if he is picked, I mean, I do think it moves us. It could move points our way. But I also think we have to. I don't think groups that have a problem with him should feel like they all of a sudden have to act like those problems have disappeared. Again, he's endorsing, despite all of our disagreements, he's endorsing our person, not the other way around. But I think he is sort of symbolic of a lot of the movement we are seeing. Yeah, actually, I think he's actually more to the right of most of the voters I'm talking about.
Yeah.
On a lot of issues, but I think that he'll be speaking to a lot of voters who are moving away from the Republican Party, and his signal that, listen, I'm kind of like you guys and I'm good with Biden. I do think that certainly will move some voters.
Mm-hmm.
And if Ohio is dead even, it will move voters potentially in a way that, that helps Biden win.
Do you see, as the chair of the Ohio Democratic Party, do you see that one-point race, and also as the author of all of these books, do you see that one-point race as being like a giant red target for Vladimir Putin? The fact that it's 1 point separates Trump and Biden, that's like fertile ground for an attack, yeah. Don't you think?
Well, what's funny, you mentioned that, not to keep going back to my books, but the reason in the People's House...
Yeah.
The reason that they were able to do what they did is because gerrymandering made it so clear what the 18 or 20 congressional targets would be. Mm-hmm. There are only a very few number of swing congressional seats. And those were the ones they rigged when they wanted to seize control of the U.S. House of Representatives. So, yeah, in the same way, if you're trying to interfere, you're going to pick, you know, the 8 or 9 states that are close. And you know, so yeah, I would think if there were a sophisticated, you know, outside of just the broader disinformation and all that, which they obviously do, yeah, I think the states that are close need to be on a special lookout for interference with all their election infrastructure, mm-hmm. and everything else, because that's where you'd go. And that was exactly the point in my first book. When the Russian oligarch understands gerrymandering, he's like, oh, this is perfect. I don't have to go interfere in 400-plus House seats. I only have to pick 20. Because
yeah.
It's those 20, and everyone knows who they are, that will determine the outcome. And in the same way, you know, the Electoral College system creates, you know, 8 or 10 states in this case that you know, the good thing this year is there are many more that we can win, so yeah. That's good. Mm-hmm. So there are more targets, but yeah, it's pretty obvious where you'd go if you wanted to cause trouble. And the other thing that I think is more worrisome, you also have, and I think Ohio is better in this regard than other states, you also have different states with different levels of vulnerability based upon their security of their election systems. And, mm-hmm. you know, Georgia, I can't speak to the most latest iteration, but they've been notorious for having purely electronic voting machines without paper trails. And again, if you wanted to go cause trouble, you'd go after those machines before you go after any others. So
yeah, yeah.
I think it's not only the map, but and who's a swing state. It's also which states have been smarter about really locking down security around their elections versus others, which would be easier to take advantage of.
What do you think, just as the last question here, David, what do you think is the other Russian shoe that's going to drop this particular cycle? Is it going to be voting machines? I'm kind of sitting on the edge of my seat waiting, like, because we haven't seen any major hacks. I'm wondering, what's Russia's MO this time around? What does the GRU and what does St. Petersburg have in store for us this time?
I think the most obvious will continue to be divisive disinformation around everything from these protests,
yeah.
and Black Lives Matter to COVID. I mean, we're already seeing a lot of that. And there's clearly, I mean, the worst thing about, you know, here's in my first book, the naive part of my book is when they discover at the end what happened, Republicans and Democrats come together and say, oh my gosh, we can't believe that happened. We must solve the problem. I actually wrote that because I thought that's what people would do.
Yeah.
And the worst part about 16 is that we all know what happened and no one's done anything about it.
Yep.
And so we've invited it again. So I think the most obvious thing that will happen is the easiest, because Facebook and others have not really done much. The continued use of you know, social media and data to just create so much confusion and disinformation, division. But you know, the more worrisome thing, and I don't want to predict anything, but the more worrisome thing for me is you know, getting into the election infrastructure of the country. It's clear that they've attempted to do that before. There's a general sense they weren't successful, but I think even that's not completely 100% known.
Yeah.
And would they be able to do that in 20? Would they also try and do the kind of things I mentioned in the book? You know, I can't imagine they wouldn't attempt to get into the critical infrastructure of campaigns and parties. I mean, if you were trying to do bad things, that's one of the first places you'd go, which is sort of the point of the book. But my, you know, of course, the broader disinformation is going to be happening. But the shoes that would be truly more damaging would be any success in getting into the infrastructure of elections,
yeah.
or the heart of campaigns, you know, be it voter file or other things that folks are doing. And you know, you can only hope that states have prepared for that. But I will say we have sent a signal to the to the world, and this is because of our dysfunctional politics. We have sent a signal to the world after 16 that if you hack in and you try and impact the outcome, nothing really happens to you. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, they're going to try again. I mean, there's no doubt about it. So, yes, we should all be – the next 97 days are a huge opportunity but also really scary. And we need to all be – I'll just give an example. I am worried sick, as I know our country is, about these federal police, quote-unquote police, showing up. Not in Portland. They just announced today. Cleveland, Milwaukee, Detroit, the big Democratic areas of swing of swing states. And the idea that this close to the election, our cities are becoming the, quote, caravans of 2020 of the election should scare us. And not to sound too paranoid, but my biggest worry, maybe it's a 10% chance, is that those, quote, unquote, police ultimately late in the election are awfully close to where we vote. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, we got a whole lot of intimidated voters. I mean, that's the kind of thing that a true bad actor would try. And the fact that they're moving these people into cities, 98 days to go, at a time where we know they want to challenge people at polls, which they've announced, all this is really creeping into really, you know, protected space of fair voting. So, no, it really, you know, this all this stuff. I mean, these police jumping out of cars and taking – I mean, that's right out of an autocrat's playbook, what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that stuff beyond what Putin's doing, you know, at this point, Bill Barr and Donald Trump seem to be every bit as capable of doing really bad stuff in our elections as any foreign country.
Mm-hmm.
And this federal police sort of creeping into different cities is – we all should be on guard for what ultimately is the plan they have with those people.
Do the Ohio Democrats and the DNC have lawyers ready to roll? I have a terrible feeling that Donald Trump is going to use this absentee ballot issue as a way to challenge the results of the election. I mean, are you guys ready to swing into action if that all goes down in and around Election Day?
The DNC and the Biden campaign obviously are gearing up. I will say, and this is special thanks to an old friend of mine, Stacey Abrams, because of support of her and other groups, we have a bigger voter protection and voter observation capacity this election than we've ever had.
Wonderful.
So just as the Republicans planned to literally, and this has been reported in the Times, but we knew it was coming. Their plan is to literally recruit thousands of operatives to show up at poll locations and challenge voters they deem quote-unquote suspicious. It's pure voter intimidation. And what are we doing? We're trying to recruit as many people to be poll observers and poll workers to protect those same voters, one voter at a time. So, we're recruiting that. We'll go to court if we have to. But we also just need people in the front lines literally protecting the right to vote. But I think you're going to see coming – you know, attacks on vote by mail. You're going to see attempts to, quote unquote, consolidate polling locations. You know, their dream election is what happened in Georgia. Huge lines, long waits, people afraid of getting the COVID. And so our push in every way possible is to get people to vote by mail early. Every early vote is a vote you can't suppress on election day. And I'll close with this, you know, again, sounding like someone who's written the books I have. I don't believe that Donald Trump is railing against vote by mail because he thinks that Democrats benefit so much more by vote by mail than Republicans. The data is very clear. It's pretty much a wash.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that vote by mail means that a whole lot of votes have gotten out of the way before whatever crazy plans they have for Election Day.
Yes.
And the real threat of vote by mail is that, you know, the term best laid plans, it interferes with their worst laid plans of how to make Election Day chaos.
Yeah.
And so the more we front load voting, the fewer votes they can throw into turmoil through having every election, every state look like Georgia's looked in that primary where people waited 4 and 5 hours. And so whenever he rails on vote by mail, I think it's sort of our safety valve. And he wants to cut off our safety valve so everyone is stuck voting on election day in a pandemic.
Well, oh my God. As terrifying as this conversation was, David, I am so grateful for your time today. Really, really appreciate it. Again, the must-read new book is called The Voter File. It's out now. Huge positive reviews for this book. So you got to check it out. Link in the description at bobsesca.com. This is required reading. Thanks so much, David. Good luck to us all.
Thanks, Bob. Yes, absolutely. We'll see you in 97 days.
Yeah,
thanks,
you bet.
Thanks for a great conversation.
You got it. Take care, my friend.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Take care. See ya.
Hold it. Don't nobody move. Let's talk about our Amazon link at bobseska.com. Whether you're shopping for yourself or if you're buying music by one of our excellent indie bands, or if you're purchasing David Pepper's great new book, don't forget to use our Amazon link just beneath the logo at bobseska.com. Our special link will take you to the front page of amazon.com where you can go shopping until you're dropping. And by doing so through our link, we receive a teeny tiny commission on some of your purchases. Thank you so much for shopping through our Amazon link.